This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The United Nations has released a new report on freedom of expression in Somalia. While the report highlights progress, it also warns there's much more to be done.
That's VOA's Jody Capua reporting. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. has grave concerns over what it calls the excessive use of force against protesters in Ethiopia. And opposition leader Jean Ping has called for a general strike in Gabon to protest the results of last week's presidential election. We have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Nigeria's government is pursuing talks with militants who have wreaked havoc on the oil industry in the Niger Delta region. Over a dozen groups have made demands of the government. Chris Stein reports from Lagos that some analysts say talking to militants will only encourage the formation of militant groups.
If Nigeria's government wants to sit down with the militant groups that have bombed pipelines in the Niger Delta, it's going to need a lot of chairs. The Niger Delta Avengers were the first group to take credit for attacks on oil infrastructure that began earlier this year. But they are not the only ones claiming to fight for a greater share of the revenue generated by Nigeria's oil industry. Groups like the Joint Niger Delta Liberation Force, Utoroga Liberation Movement, Red Scorpion, and the reformed Egbesu Boys have popped up in recent weeks, announcing their presence with statements posted to social media or emailed to journalists. Some, like the Niger Delta Greenland Justice Mandate, have claimed attacks. Others have merely issued demands. The profusion of groups does not sit well with some. The chairman of a development organization based in the Delta city of Wari, Edward Akpoko, said the government's move to negotiate encourages more militancy.
They are criminals, man. Their activities is criminal. You see, it's like saying government should harmonize armed robbers so that they can dialogue with them not to rob again. It's an impossibility.
Nigeria's economy is in a recession. Quelling the emerging militancy in the Delta is seen as key to ensuring Nigeria's long-term prosperity. Nigeria's state-owned oil company said last week that further attacks risked crippling the oil industry. Crude production in Nigeria has already dropped to 1.5 million barrels per day. This year's budget assumes production of 2.2 million barrels per day. Oil is Nigeria's top export, but the Niger Delta has long been mired in poverty. A similar insurgency was quelled in 2009, after Nigeria instituted a program to pay militants a monthly stipend and provide job training. An attorney and former police officer in the Delta, Edward Oforome, says dialogue will help the government understand what these groups want.
Whether they are justified or not, we come up why they are discussing.
Spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari did not respond to requests for comment. Negotiations are not the only tactic the government is trying. Nigeria's military sent troops into the Delta last month as part of Operation Crocodile Smile, an operation targeted at militant groups and criminals in the Delta. The head of the governance team at the Niger Delta-based Center for Environment, Human Rights and Development, Lawrence Dubé, said little is known about these new militant groups. Some could be splinter groups of larger organizations that are riding their coattails as a way to get government concessions. But he supported negotiations as the best way to ensure a peaceful resolution to the ongoing crisis.
They first have to negotiate to make sure that the people will join their arms.
Military action alone, Dubé warned, would only encourage more people to pick up arms. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, has called for an independent investigation of how the Ethiopian government has responded to recent protests. Power says the U.S. has grave concerns over what it calls the excessive use of force against protesters. Her remarks come 3 weeks after a similar demand was made by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein. Meanwhile, the outgoing U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia, Patricia Haslak, says Ethiopia can prosper and be strong only when all voices are heard. She called on the government to respect democratic rights enshrined in the Constitution. In other news on Ethiopia, AFP reports the government has announced one person was killed in Saturday's fire at the Kilinto prison. However, local media say the death toll could be as high as 20. Relatives of inmates are seeking news about their loved ones. The United Nations has released a new report on freedom of expression in Somalia. It's entitled Striving to Widen Democratic Space in Somalia's Political Transition. While the report highlights progress, it also warns there's much more to be done. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
UN Special Representative in Somalia, Michael Keating, spoke Sunday to reporters in Mogadishu about the new report.
This is the first ever human rights report issued by the UN on Somalia. So this is a very significant day.
The nearly 60-page report covers the period from 2012 to the present. It's being released as Somalia gets ready for parliamentary elections.
We thought this was the right time to emphasize the importance of freedom of expression to Somalia's political future. Freedom of expression is good for accountability, it is good for stability, it is good for security. And that is why we wanted to release it now.
Keating says the report highlights the encouraging progress made toward more accountable government and a more inclusive electoral process. He says the rebuilding of state institutions is fully underway in Somalia. And he praises recent legislation to establish a National Human Rights Commission.
The state formation process in recent years has been characterized by multiple consultations and received wide media coverage without any apparent censorship. In other words, Somalis are finding ways to talk publicly, more widely, more people are talking, more people are joining the national conversation, and that is very important.
Keating says traditional media are being joined by growing social media in Somalia.
But despite such achievements, there are still too many examples of the denial of freedom of expression. The UNSOM Human Rights and Protection Group has documented the killing of 30 journalists and media workers in Somalia between 2012 and this year. Two of the victims were women, and 10 of the deaths have been attributed to Al-Shabaab militants.
Also, he says 120 instances of arbitrary arrest and detention of journalists, media workers, and owners of media outlets by security forces were recorded between January 2014 and July of this year. Half of the cases occurred in Somaliland. The UN Special Representative says that attacks, threats of attacks, and other forms of harassment muzzle journalists by promoting self-censorship on politically sensitive issues, such as government corruption and human rights violations.
While the killings, beatings, and harassment of journalists receive press coverage and are highlighted, quite rightly, by media organizations and human rights defenders, Somali authorities rarely investigate these cases thoroughly, and nor are those responsible prosecuted. Violence against political leaders restricts freedom of expression and undermines efforts to establish democratic space in this country.
Keating says since 2012, 18 members of parliament have been assassinated. He outlines some of the UN report's recommendations to improve freedom of expression in Somalia.
The federal government should review and withdraw laws and practices that currently restrict and endanger the right to freedom of expression. The federal government should bring the country's 2016 media law in line with regional and international norms and standards. The AU sets a very high bar, the UN does too, so do countries in the region, and so should Somalia.
The report calls on the next Somali federal government to take steps to ensure the rights of women to join the political process. It recommends what it calls effective oversight of the National Intelligence and Security Agency to prevent recurring human rights violations. And the report says since legislation was passed to set up a National Human Rights Commission, the government should promptly do so and give it its full support. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The government of South Sudan has accepted the deployment of a UN-mandated regional protection force. The announcement was made yesterday following a meeting between President Salva Kiir and a UN delegation. Details still need to be worked out on the actual deployment of the 4,000-strong force. The UN says the protection force is needed to improve security in the country. You are listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Sixteen past the hour is a recap of our top stories. According to U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, the U.S. has grave concerns over what it calls the excessive use of force against protesters in Ethiopia. And observers estimate more than a dozen militant groups are attacking Nigeria's oil industry in the Niger Delta, and negotiations may not be a good idea. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. In Gabon, opposition leader Jean Ping has called for a general strike. Reuters reports that Ping wants to protest the results of last week's presidential election. He calls the vote count fraudulent. Incumbent Ali Bongo was declared the winner. The Bongo family has ruled Gabon for more than 40 years. Violence broke out last Wednesday after the vote count was announced. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke to both men by phone yesterday, urging an end to further violence. Mr. Ban said he deplored the loss of life last week. The capital, Libreville, is reported calm today. Over the past year, Zimbabwe has struggled with a severe drought that threatens huge portions of its rural population with malnutrition and hunger. The main cause of this drought was a Pacific Ocean climate cycle called El Niño, which profoundly affects wind, rainfall, and other weather patterns. For the first part of our two-part series on food security in Zimbabwe, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Eddie Rowe, the director of the World Food Program in Zimbabwe. Rowe explained that the WFP's drought aid is a departure from what has been the UN agency's normal work in Zimbabwe.
In Zimbabwe, over the last 10 years, most of WFP's activities were geared towards saving lives because of intermittent food crisis through climate-induced shocks or economic impacts. But then we've seen a shift from 2014 because we are hit by this El Nino, which has caused a massive drought impacting the agricultural sector. When you travel to communities, at a time like this when people would be relying on their own harvests, less than 15% of the rural households were able to harvest food that would be enough for 6 weeks. The good thing here is that there is a significant number of assistance internationally and locally. But I must say that moving around, some of the regions where livestock is the predominant livelihood activities, they experienced loss of cattle. And those who were smart enough had to sell off, you know, their cattle at a giveaway price simply because it is better to have $10, $15 than to lose the cattle. There are no pastures. Water is very difficult to come by. people will just sell them off rather than allow them to die. However, the economic situation is also impacting the basic lives of Zimbabweans in the cities and towns where you have huge, significant numbers of unemployment, delayed salaries, and the general cost of living.
And you see physical evidence of the drought sort of in people's faces? I mean, are they very thin? Are the kids bloated?
I would not say you see physical evidence. Perhaps what we are seeing is the significant deterioration on the nutritional status of children under 5 years. So that, yes, is evident. And another thing I should say is, and this is not so evident, is the fact that about 13% of the population is HIV/AIDS. Because of limited access to food, some of these HIV/AIDS patients that are on their drugs are refusing to continue with their drugs simply because they cannot get adequate food that would sustain them once they continue on their drugs. I spoke to one patient who told me that these drugs are very, very strong, and when you take them, you need to have adequate food. And therefore, rather than taking the drugs, which eventually, you know, without food would have a major negative impact, they would rather prefer not to take the drugs until they are guaranteed food. In our own targeting criteria, we try to identify these vulnerable groups to ensure that they are on our food assistance program.
That was Eddie Rowe, director of the UN World Food Program in Zimbabwe. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips. Tunisia's uprising was the birthplace of the Arab Spring, but many young Tunisians still cannot find jobs. Rural areas remain neglected and lack of social programs. Some analysts say the lack of jobs and scarce economic development are fertile ground for radicalization and recruitment by terror groups. Anwar Bukars is a scholar in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
These unaddressed challenges are making it harder also to secure the country from internal upheaval and terrorism. As you noted, aggrieved youths in the interior and in the border regions are increasingly, you know, expressing their anger in fiery protests and street violence. The Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State presence just across the Libyan border further compounds this growing terror threat, as was amply underlined by the March 2016 dramatic terror assault on security forces in the border town of Benguerir. So the challenge for Tunisia is to try to understand this youth revolt. So far, unfortunately, all post-Ben Ali governments have failed, you know, to grasp these processes of political, social, and religious radicalization. They have failed to improve governance and deliver on the two main demands of the 2011 uprising, which are jobs and human dignity.
So with continued high unemployment rate and social grievances that are not dealt with, what do Tunisian youth have to do?
Well, there is unfortunately not much outlet out there. As I said, the challenge is that so far all governments, unfortunately, have failed to address those grievances. That's why we see more young people taken to the streets. Sometimes those protests turn in violence. Others have joined violent extremist groups across the border in Libya. Some went to Syria. Some developments are also particularly worrisome, as you have seen in the news. I mean, the old repressive habits of the police and security services are back in full swing. The grand designs to reform the security sector have been abandoned. The all-powerful Ministry of Interior remains an unreconstructed bastion of secrecy and impunity. So that's the challenge. The focus so much is on security, that addressing the problems of high unemployment, of underdevelopment in the interior regions and in the border regions have been pushed to the back burner. And that's a major problem.
But Tunisia resources are very limited, especially after the uprising. What do you recommend to remedy disparities in Tunisia to prevent radicalization?
Well, first, there has has to be a political will. That's number one. Unfortunately, the leadership, you know, even after the revolution, for the most part, with the exception when Tunisia was in power, you know, hails from the eastern coast. And so there have been neglect. I think the West, Tunisia's allies, have a major role to play in helping the country establish that equilibrium between security, liberty, and development. The United States and the EU, as you said, given the limited resources that Tunisia has, should significantly increase their economic aid, as well as mobilize international support and resources to ease the social situation, especially in Tunisia's interior and border regions. That's one element. Another element which is equally important is that the United States and its European allies should put pressure on the current Tunisian government to keep its infringement on civil liberties in check. Because the war on terrorism necessarily forces an adjustment in the balance between Tunisian people's hard-won liberties and the state security imperatives. That's fair. But the need to adopt tougher security measures to deal with terrorist threats should not lead to grave violations of human rights, because it instills in young, disenchanted people profound feelings of bitterness towards state authority. And they are also the best recruiting tools for terrorist groups. So the United States and its allies should, I think, increase economic aid significantly, especially in the border regions and the interior. But they should also push the government to reform its internal security apparatus and, frankly, to promote standards of professionalism.
Anwar Boukars is a scholar in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Chenawi. Italian authorities say about 500 migrants and refugees were rescued on the Mediterranean over the weekend. They also report at least six bodies were recovered. Meanwhile, Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban is raising concerns about the European Union deal with Turkey. He says the agreement to stop the flow of Syrian and Iraqi refugees into Greece is fragile. Also, Czech President Milos Zeman says the EU should help Bulgaria guard its border with Turkey. And in North France, hundreds of truckers and farmers on tractors blocked a major highway today. They demanded the closure of a migrant camp in Calais, known as the jungle. There are about 7,000 people in the informal camp. Many hope to find a way to reach Great Britain. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunnyside of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wagner Roberts, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, choosing the hero, my improbable journey, and the rise of Africa's first woman president. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, the 2012 Nobel Peace Prize winner and president of Liberia, is a subject of a new book by River Levinson, an in-depth discussion on the life and career of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is next week, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election right here on VOA.